suspended because you can't pay a traffic ticket and you lose your job or can't get a job because your driver's license is suspended, then you're even less likely to be able to pay the ticket to get your license back.
If you can't afford to pay the ticket and a $60 state-imposed reinstatement fee, Lund explains that there are options.
The law requires municipal courts to give low-income people alternatives to driver's license suspension, such as payment plans or community service, but people don't always know about these options, and they can be afraid to go to court when they can't pay.
Payment plans take into account an individual's income. For community service, most courts give credit of about $10 per hour for volunteer work at a public agency or a nonprofit organization. To help people who can't afford to pay their tickets and get their licenses back, Racine Municipal Court Judge Rebecca Mason is holding a license recovery day this Thursday, the 29th, from 1 till 4 p.m. But Deputy Court Clerk Stephanie Kozer explained this is a limited and targeted event.
The only people that qualify are individuals that have a municipal citation with the City of Racine Municipal Court that they have not paid, and we have suspended their driver's license. So this does not include any other municipality like Mount Pleasant, Caledonia, Racine County.
For information and an appointment for License Recovery Day on Thursday the 29th, call the Racine Municipal Clerk's Office at 636-9263. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath.
Sports in the NHL last night. Vegas beat Chicago by a score of 8-3. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Increasing clouds today, a high around 26. Snow overnight, less than a half inch possible, a low around 24. Right now, clear skies, temperature reading of 10. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And isn't that a fun way to begin the Wednesday morning show? This is the opening movement of the Neguza Saba Suite by Glenn Burley. And this wonderful work that celebrates the holiday of Kwanzaa is going to be performed this weekend at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. In part one of today's morning show, I'm really happy to welcome back to the program Dr. James Kinchin, who is Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and he will be presiding over this weekend's performances of the Neguza Saba Suite, which has been done at Parkside before. But whether or not you've experienced this work before or never have, you want to think very seriously about taking the opportunity to experience the energy and color and vitality of this joyous work in person. Dr. James Kinchin, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Good morning. It's great to be here. Great to be back.
Happy to have you here. And we're going to play some excerpts from this work, and we're going to talk about the composer of it, the great and much-missed Glenn Burley,
yes,
whom I know you knew very, very well and who
yes
was on this program on several occasions. I thought what would be interesting, however, is to actually begin with this thing called Kwanzaa.
Yes.
This Neguza Saba Suite is directly tied to what this holiday of Kwanzaa is all about. So let's start there by explaining to our listeners kind of the origins of Kwanzaa, a relatively new holiday, and what it's all about, some of its basic tenets.
Yeah. Well, so Kwanzaa begins in the latter part of the 60s, which, of course, you know, we can situate today as a time with increased awareness of Black people, of culture, of their own culture, increased pride, and a sense of agency, you know, in terms of doing things for ourselves that hadn't really existed to that magnitude. And so here was the idea of a holiday that would somehow get around the extreme commercialism of Christmas. And I kind of smile at that because this is before Black Friday and Cyber Monday and all of that. But the thought was that rather than to focus on, you know, who's giving gifts to whom and how many gifts are we giving and who's getting what, that we would focus instead on some of the positive values, which are values that all people, I think, embrace. Things like unity, things like faith, the sense of purpose that we all have, being creative, all of those kinds of things. And so the idea came up that we would have a holiday and it would be situated between Christmas and New Year's. 7 days, and for each of the 7 days, one of the principles of Kwanzaa. So, for example, Umoja, which means unity, or Imani, which means faith. So every day would have a principle. Every day would have a celebration, and so that's how it began. So you fast forward to 1993, which is when I'm first getting to know Glenn Burley and making the overture to him, do you accept commissions? Is sort of the first question, and he said yes. And I said, well, would you be interested in writing something for us? And he said in his totally candid, characteristic fashion, I don't know. I'll think about it. So he thought about it, and he got back with me, and he said, yes, I'd be very much interested in that. And then the question came up with almost every commission, unless you go into it with a presupposition of what the product will be, what shall I write? And I said, well, what do you know about Kwanzaa? And there's not a whole lot of Kwanzaa music, which is ironic because music is so integral to African American culture.
Right.
I mean, it's just you know, there is almost indispensable.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's very little Kwanzaa music. So he thought about that. He said, I like the idea. I've heard of Kwanzaa. I don't know much about it. So in that day and time, before the internet really came online, part of that fun, and now you can Google something and you can get a zillion hits with it.
Mm-hmm.
But back in that time, I found a couple of little books on Kwanzaa and mailed them to him. And from that, The seed was planted, and he began to think about what this piece would be, not just in terms of the music, but also the text. Because, you know, if there's no real Kwanzaa music tradition, there is no Kwanzaa text that you can kind of go to, like, you know, you want to do a mass setting. Well, here's the ordinary of the mass. You just set those words to music.
As have been done hundreds, if not thousands of times before.
But these words are all his words based on his understandings and his internalizations of these Kwanzaa principles, the Nguzo Saba, as
they're called. Interesting. Yeah. So he surely, of course, had heard of Kwanzaa, but it sounds like maybe he did not have the same maybe intimate understanding or familiarity with it that, for instance, you did.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
So how long did it take Glenn Burley to put this work together? I'm imagining that a work like that could not possibly take shape overnight, especially if it had to begin with some period of personal exploration for him.
Well, you know, we uttered the commission in 1993, funded, I'm happy to say, by our UW Parkside 25th anniversary fund, which was a great idea, because somebody there in the higher echelons was smart enough to realize that, hey, let's just make this money available to people around campus, have them write proposals, and we'll fund the best ideas. And our idea got funded.
Wow.
So that's how we came up with the money. So that was 93. 94 was when he actually started working in earnest on the suite. And toward the fall is when we began to get movement. Again, back in that day, things came in the mail, and they were actually handwritten manuscripts. The first of the seven movements that he composed was Kuumba, which is creativity. And he sent that to me, and I was so excited to get it. And, of course, you know, I'd always call him and, tell him that I got it. And after having looked at it, you know, if I had questions about it or whatever, and I was just delighted to get this. And really began at that moment when I looked at the first thing that he sent, the Kuumba, to get a glimpse of his profound insight and his kind of spiritual connection with his concept. Because, you know, you say creativity to an artist, well, you're thinking composing and arranging, and perhaps if you're in some of the other arts, painting and sculpting and writing plays and doing poetry and all of those things. For him, creativity was how can we come up with those ideas that will help us connect with the needs of the community and make the world a better place.
Wow, okay? What a great thought, especially for this time of year. So the words are his. What is the language?
Well, the language is all English except for the titles. The titles are Swahili, or I guess more properly, Kiswahili, which is one of the languages spoken in various parts of West Africa. And so back, going back again to the origins of Kwanzaa back in the 60s, that was sort of a thing that people in the know thought you ought to be able to speak a little bit of Swahili. And so that's why the original titles of each of the principles is a Swahili principle, is in the Swahili language. And of course, the idea, too, was that there was, in the original formulation of the holiday, a kind of pan-African spirit, so that people of color on this continent could feel connection with people of color on the motherland continent. And so there was not this sense of being separate so much as let's really celebrate our commonalities. And so Swahili was one of the ways that was attempted.
Of course. Fantastic. Let's hear something else from the work. I was thinking, should we perhaps hear a little bit of Kuumba, the first movement that he finished?
That would be great.
And what do you want to say about this movement before we hear a little bit of it?
Well, it's nice and broad and noble in tempo. And it's sort of a verse and refrain structure after the introduction. And there's the unison verses where different needs are spoken of. And I was saying to my choir in rehearsal how timely and how pertinent those things are even now, even though he conceived them almost a quarter of a century ago. He talks about helping the illiterate person learn to read and write. He talks about helping the person on the drug. And you think now about the opioid crisis, for example. He talks about homelessness and all of those things that are still human needs. And there's a little pun in that because Kuumba, K-U-U-M-B-A for the listener, the Swahili word, is also his pun with Kumba as in Kumbaya, which is the spiritual that was taken from the U.S. and transported also into Africa. And so there's a little play on words, Kuumba, Kumbaya.
There we go. So let's hear a little bit of this movement, number six, Kuumba, from the Neguza Saba suite of Glenn Burley. Creativity comes from you.
Yes.
This is the Neguza Saba suite of Glenn Burley. We're listening to the Nathaniel Dett Chorale.
Yes.
In this recording of this wonderful work, which is going to be performed this weekend at Parkside. So this was commissioned as part of Parkside's 25th anniversary,
yes,
and
yes.
Here we are in the 50th anniversary year.
Yes, yes.
So I'm sure that's one of the reasons why you want to do this piece.
Yes.
As a choral educator, what do you see as maybe especially beneficial for your young students at Parkside in doing a work like this? I mean, what sort of meaningful challenges does it present to them, or in what way is this a significant musical and artistic experience for your singers?
Yeah. Well, for starters, it's tremendous music. The composer always has sort of his best idea cap on, if you will, as he takes us through this piece. And there's something that happens, and I think you can agree, when people come in contact with meaningful ideas by great composers. I mean, and it happens on many levels. Now, that said, I also liked, and one of the things that attracted me first to Glenn Burley's music was how he pulls together these seemingly disparate styles. So, for example, the more classical approach, there's jazz, there's gospel, there's even a moment or two of blues. And while the piece was playing just a moment ago, the conversation between us at the listeners wouldn't have heard, is talking about Glenn's chords. So you know, all of that coming together into this one meaningful and coherent musical expression is a great thing for the students here. And then the text and how that is so sensitive to human need and how that speaks relevantly to us today. You know, when I, for example, was in a rehearsal and we were talking about Help Me Save the Drowning Man on the Drug, and it was sort of like, kind of, you know, blasé. And I was like, so guys, how many of you have heard of the opioid crisis? You know, and then people began to just focus that, that there are people who are dying because of addiction. This is about addiction. It's not something 500 years ago. That it's not the plague or something. This is something. And it is a plague. But
this
I mean,
is our plague.
Yeah. But I mean, this is something that's happening now that's affecting us now. People are hopeless now. People are in need of encouragement now. And so they begin to connect with it at that level as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
Back to Kwanzaa for just a moment. You were explaining that Kwanzaa spans the 7 days between essentially Christmas Day and New Year's Day. For the typical family, how is Kwanzaa typically observed? I mean, for instance, what is done on each of those 7 days to observe these tenets of Kwanzaa?
Yeah. Well, you know, that can vary. And usually what happens in the instances where I have been involved, when I've not been mobile, as I have to explain that because this is not my home very often. In that time, I'm traveling down south to visit some of my family. But usually it's a more of a communal thing where it's several families who get together. And they have poems that they share, songs that they share. People will speak sort of spontaneously, in some cases, about the particular principle that's being observed on that day. So, for example, if it is, you know, Kumba, creativity. And then that's one that people will find different ways of approaching. There will be usually some sort of ritual libation, which is usually just sort of a tea or a punch or something. And then people will fellowship and will commingle with each other. But it's as much about the interaction of people as anything else, as they celebrate that principle. And then the next day or the next evening, there's another principle. There's some places where the celebration will actually go from home to home and family to family. And there are other places where it's held in a central location and people are invited to come for each of the celebratory days of the holiday.
By the way, do you happen to know who created Kwanzaa? I mean, was it any particular official body or?
I'll have to get that's sort of at the tip of my tongue, and
sure.
I can't get. But there was a person who actually did that, who actually got that ball to rolling.
Right.
And I can't call that name right.
No, no problem. And it's probably important for us to also say that this is not a holiday that necessarily or maybe even regularly replaces Christmas.
No.
In no way does it supplant Christmas.
But
what a wonderful enhancement to Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever else one might also be celebrating this time of year.
Yeah.
We're speaking Wednesday morning, and the performances are this weekend. So.
They are this weekend, and we would like to have people to come to witness this performance for the first time, or if you have heard it before, come and hear it again. I mean, you know, we listen to some of the masterworks. Most of us would not say Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Oh, I've heard that.
Right, yeah, exactly.
So come hear it again.
Once was enough.
Once is not enough in this case. Friday. Saturday, December 1st. Okay, that's a 7 p.m. performance, Saturday, December 1st. And then the Sunday performance is 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So December 1st, Saturday, 7 p.m., December 2nd, Sunday, 3 p.m. both performances in Bedford Concert Hall in the Rita on our campus, UW Parkside campus. The tickets are very reasonably priced, $10 for adults, $5 for students. They may be obtained at the box office during the week, or can be purchased at the door as well. And I should tell you, our choirs will be joined by members of Zest Choir, Our Musical Life, which is a fairly new Racine Children's Choir initiative. And we'll also be joined by some members from Heritage Chorale. Off and on as we perform this through the years, Heritage Chorale of Milwaukee has joined us in performances. We're happy to welcome them again. And Word in Motion Dance Ministry from St. Paul Baptist Church in Racine. They're going to choreograph and dance this work, and it's going to be just an incredible just treat for everybody who comes.
Wow. About how long a work is this?
This work is about 35 minutes or so. And so there will be other entrees on the program leading up to this. This will be the focal work. And it's a little more than half an hour. And there will be other pieces as well. So and people will get a chance to do communal carol singing as well as part of the program.
Fantastic. Yeah. So, again, this is Saturday night and Sunday afternoon at the University of Wisconsin Parkside in Francis Bedford Hall.
Francis Bedford Concert Hall,
Such a beautiful place to enjoy music.
An incredible place.
Absolutely. Yeah. I say with gratitude and envy. Absolutely beautiful place. So the Naguza Saba Suite by the much-missed Glenn Burley, wonderful gentleman. And so what a lovely treat and what a nice way to enhance the 50th anniversary celebration for the University of Wisconsin-Parkside.
Yes.
And at the helm for this concert, Dr. James Kinchin. Dr. Kinchin, it's always great to have you on the morning show, and best wishes to you and all of your many musicians who are part of this special performance this weekend.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be here, Greg.
And here's just a little bit more of Glenn Burley's Naguza Saba Suite to finish out part one of today's morning show. Part two to come up in a moment. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. It's exactly 8:40, and here is part two of today's program. And for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, I'm really excited to be able to welcome back into our studios Chris Paulson, who is Executive Director of the Racine Heritage Museum. And he is here to talk about a very special exhibit that opens this Saturday. It is an exhibit that will celebrate the work of a sculptor, an Italian-American sculptor by the name of Alfonso Iannelli. And we have not only Chris Paulson with us to talk about this, but also someone who is quite an expert on this remarkable man's remarkable work. His name is Tim Samuelson, and he is cultural historian for the city of Chicago. And he has been a great help to Chris and the staff at the Racine Heritage Museum in helping to procure this exhibit and to see to its successful mounting. And the public, again, gets to view it for the first time this Saturday.
Chris Paulson, Tim Samuelson, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Good to have you
Thanks
here.
Thank you very much.
Tim Samuelson, before we go any further and before we talk a little bit about Mr. Iannelli and his work as a sculptor, I want to find out what a cultural historian for the city of Chicago does. What would be the kind of the scope and the primary focus of your duties as Chicago's official cultural historian?
Oh, my, cultural historian for the city of Chicago. What a heavy burden to bear. Actually, it's a great gig. I get to work with doing exhibits, programs, arranging tours, anything to do with Chicago's cultural history, which takes all kinds of different directions. So it's fun. And then even it's involved, people call me up with questions on the phone about a company that their grandfather worked for, you know, 50, 60 years ago. And I'm almost embarrassed that I can actually answer most of them. It's kind of the job's like a combination of Lightning, Jeopardy, and Russian roulette.
Hmm. And it sounds like it's the kind of job where no 2 days are exactly the same.
That's right. When the phone rings or somebody comes in or you come up with an idea, it takes it from there. So it's a great gig.
Right. Very good. Well, we're glad you're making time in your schedule to be part of the morning show today, and it's going to be great to hear from you about this intriguing man by the name of Alfonso Iannelli. Chris Paulson, let's begin with you, though. Explain why this exhibit belongs at the Racine Heritage Museum, what the connection is with Racine, at least in general.
Well, it's a remarkable connection to both some Racine churches and to two Racine companies that are reflected in the archival collection of Alfonso Iannelli that these gentlemen, Tim and his colleagues, David Jameson and Eric O'Malley, introduced me to. Iannelli started, he was born in 1888. He was a designer, working out, and Tim, correct me when I'm wrong, it took him out to the West Coast early in his career, but he came back to Chicago working with Frank Lloyd Wright, designed the sprites at Midway Gardens, went on to a remarkable career as a sculptor, as a designer, and really emphasized modernism in his artistic approach, and also a commitment to making his artwork accessible to ordinary people. And that took the form, like we've said, we keep talking about church designs, but Iannelli did the beautiful stained glass windows at St. Patrick's Church in Racine, as well as the altar, a number of other items there, including the sculpture that is there. And he did the same thing at St. Catherine's High School. He also worked for Oster Company, designing the beautiful chrome streamlined mid-century products for that company. And then even proposed some redesign of packaging for Horlick Company. And so we're very fortunate to have access to this remarkable collection, and it includes a number of his, he's got a number of studies, blueprints, different design elements, and the products that correspond to them. Mm. The real star of the show undoubtedly is a series of nearly full-size charcoal and Conte crayon studies. They're called cartoons of the stained glass windows at St. Patrick's Church.
Ah, and this would be something that Mr. Iannelli himself would have crafted.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, he created them, and they were found in his studio. And so these materials, these gentlemen I mentioned, have been just a joy to work with. They're wonderful. They know their stuff, and as you'll talk to Tim, you'll find out they're off the wall in terms of just the way they look at exhibitions and how we can do things. The exhibit is titled Blessings to Blenders, Spreading the Gospel of Modernism, Alfonso Iannelli in Wisconsin. So my wife thought that she did, well, that's delightfully, mildly blasphemous.
I like it very much. As someone who's not even a fan of blasphemy, I do like I like that a lot. Tim Samuelson, explain to us where these materials have been. Tell us more about this privately held collection and your own connection to it.
Well, interestingly, Alfonso Iannelli never threw anything away. He kept everything stashed away in his studio. After he died in 1965, there was a kind of wayward journey of his materials, where at first they were going to be given to a museum here in Chicago. The family took the materials back. An art dealer got a hold of them. Some of them got scattered on eBay. But myself and some colleagues were determined to try to pull the collection back together again. We even went back to the dealer who had gotten the materials years ago. We found some of the things in his chicken coop. And we were able to find drawings and sketches that documented his work. And one of the great discoveries were these really tattered, filthy, crumbling paper, what looked like just scrolls rolled up. And if you tried to open them, they'd start to rip. And these were these amazing full-size patterns. They called them cartoons, to create Racine's St. Patrick's Church windows. And they're like almost 9 feet tall. And we were able to restore them, put them back together again, and clean them up. And they are impressive. But also, many of the sketches and the drawings for Oster, we have those on display. And almost all the materials are from the artist's own personal archive that he squirreled away and kept all of his life.
Hmm. And who's had them more recently?
They are part of an interactive archive that we have that we call the Chicago Architectural Preservation Archive. It's called CAPA. And it is devoted to making historical materials easily accessible for schools and museums, kind of spreading the word of history by, especially we love the idea of working with smaller museums and doing things that relate to their regional history and just basically saying, here's the material, run with it. And that's exactly what Chris has done at Racine. So before that, they were with various art dealers. Some of it actually was bought ingloriously on eBay just to rescue it.
Mm. Very good. So the Racine Heritage Museum is exactly the kind of institution that you were talking about then.
Yes, and it's interesting. There are many large museums who have certain restrictions that are just very challenging for smaller museums to meet, and they won't make the materials available. And we love it. And of course, I have a museum background, and common sense tells me that there is no problem with these materials going to a smaller institution that may not have, you know, some of the requirements of humidity and things that some places regard. And also the idea of a place that will be adventuresome with how to present them and kind of break free of, you know, old museum practice. So in some ways this is a rebellious spirit behind the whole thing.
For those of you just joining us, we have on the phone with us Tim Samuelson, who is cultural historian for the city of Chicago. And with us in the studio as well is Chris Paulson, who is executive director of the Racine Heritage Museum. And beginning this Saturday, the public can see a brand new exhibit that opens there that will feature some of the works of this Italian-American sculptor by the name of Alfonso Iannelli. Tim Samuelson, what more do you want to tell us about Mr. Iannelli that makes him an especially remarkable and intriguing figure?
What makes Iannelli really different among artists, he was a sculptor, but he also was a painter and worked in industrial design. And Iannelli was passionate about spreading the word of modernism and the power of modernism to stir people's senses. He absolutely had no interest in creating artworks that would be in a rarefied museum of an art gallery or an art museum. He wanted to make modernism something that would be part of people's everyday lives from all walks of life. So what he devoted his modernism to was things like advertising, architectural decoration, product design, things that people would encounter in their homes and see every day. Hmm. And so modernism would be comfortably part of your life and not just something kind of rarefied and hanging up in a gallery or a museum somewhere. And this meant designing the architectural sculpture and windows in a church, which even just by walking by the building, it's something that you are impressed by, even if you're not a member of the church itself. And he designed the Oster appliances as little mini works of modern art that could sit right on your kitchen counter, and it would be useful as well as beautiful. And he was passionate about doing things like this. And so the Racine things actually are a great cross-section of how diverse that scope is. And that's why it is, from the blessings of creating reverence in a church through modernism to creating something that is useful in your kitchen for making a malted milk. It's the same philosophy.
By the way, these the centerpiece that Chris was talking about, these so-called cartoons of these stained glass windows, what would the purpose of these cartoons have been? Are these something that would have served as, for instance, a model or a guide for those who actually created these windows, or would these cartoons have served some other function or purpose?
They are basically patterns, and so these were what were created by Iannelli in his studio, full size, with the thickness of the leading and the detail that is fused onto the glass. These were then taken to a glassmaking shop in Chicago, where it was literally used to lay these drawings out on a table and fabricate and cut the glass and set the leading according to, it's like a roadmap of where everything goes. Also, it's interesting, these are done in black and white charcoal, and it's called Conti crayon, but they were executed in brilliant color. So not only is this exhibit at the Racine Heritage Museum, it's also worth going down to visit the actual sites and see the colors of these. But on these cartoons, and I'd say it's not cartoons like normally, that's what you call a pattern for a window, you will see little penciled notations where it indicates color on some of the pieces. So you get a window, literally a window, into how windows are made.
Fascinating. Chris, what challenge has it been to just physically mount this exhibit, and are you done with that process as we record this interview on Tuesday morning?
Very nearly we are done. I don't know that I've ever had an exhibit completed within more than a couple hours of its opening, but I think we're looking pretty good here. The challenge has been working in a small but very beautiful space, and I've been so grateful to the gentlemen that have been working with us on this. I rarely get to work on exhibits anymore, but it is why I got into the museum field. And when an opportunity like this comes up, it's just a joy for me to get my hands dirty and work on things. And I have to say that Tim and David and Eric have, you know, really kind of just given me an exhibit kit to put together. It's pretty straightforward, pretty simple. And so the only challenge, you know, from my end is making sure that it's suited to the space and that things are going to be safe. But the space itself is, and I think the last time I was here was with Gary from the sports hall.
Yes.
Gary Weffel and I were talking about that. That exhibit area is a permanent exhibit gallery at the museum. It was designed by Racine's architect, Bob Hartman. Beautiful space. And on the outside of that space, he wrapped a very pretty prairie-style exhibit gallery around the outside of the sports hall. And so there's this kind of neat juxtaposition of themes, and somehow they sort of fit together, you know, particularly with art that is really sort of intended to be kind of at the street level, you know, at the available to people in the same similar way we talk about sports as being a kind of a you know, an opportunity to bring people together. You know, it's there for everyone. And so that theme kind of carries through this space, and the items look wonderful in the space. It's neat. And, you know, for us to have a small museum with a facility with the limitations that we do, to have these magnificent drawings in it, they really just explode in your eyes when you walk in.
So how long will this exhibit be on display there?
It'll be up for 1 year through October of next year.
Fantastic. And the public's first opportunity to see it is this Saturday. What are the hours of the Racine Heritage Museum?
Hours of the museum are Saturdays 10 to 3. I'll give you that one first. Sunday 12 to 4. Tuesday to Friday 9 to 5. We do participate in the First Fridays program most of the year, so there are some evening options as well.
And Tim Samuelson, will you be able to make your way to Racine and see this exhibit as it is mounted at the Racine Heritage Museum? Will you get to see it with your own eyes?
I wouldn't miss it. In fact, it's really interesting how it comes out. I mean, it's wonderful to suddenly, you know, to go to someone like Chris and say, I've got a 9-foot-high drawing for you, and didn't freak out and really ran with the idea of how to display him. So, and the idea of juxtaposing these elements in that great old former Carnegie Library, I'm really excited to see it.
Absolutely. Well, we appreciate the help that you have provided to make this possible. Tim Samuelson, cultural historian for the City of Chicago. Great to have you part of the morning show today. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
And Chris Paulson, executive director of the Racine Heritage Museum, thank you as well. Best wishes to you and everybody at the museum.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Greg.
I'm Gregory Berg.
We will be spending most of the Thursday morning show talking about a marvelous play that is being performed at the University of Wisconsin Parkside this weekend, a play called Midnight for Mo Flanders. And we speak with the director of the production, Brian Gill, who is from the theater faculty at UW Parkside, and also with the playwright, Marie Kohler. We recorded this interview yesterday, and it was a really fascinating conversation about how playwrights do what they do. In this particular case, taking a well-known novel from the 19th century, or actually earlier than that, and transforming it into a first-rate play. And so we have that conversation for you on tomorrow's morning show. On Friday, you'll hear my conversation with Michael Hebb, who's written a most intriguing book on how to have conversations about death. And his very intriguing proposition is that we should have those conversations at dinner with friends. And he has written a book that